And welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. My name is Mark Williams, and I'm delighted today to be able to introduce to you our guest, Mr. Peter Keller, who is the chair of the board of directors of CLNG, the industry body that promotes the use of LNG as the only currently viable marine fuel that can cut greenhouse gas emissions at the point of combustion, and I'm sure we'll hear with modern technology also on a well-to-wake basis. CLNG brings together key players from across the supply chain, including shipping companies, classification societies, ports, LNG suppliers, downstream companies, infrastructure providers, and original equipment manufacturers. It's a not-for-profit collaborative industry foundation. Peter will be known to many of you. He's a former executive vice president of Tote Maritime. He joined Tote Maritime in 2012 as president of SeaStar Line, which is now Tote Maritime Puerto Rico. And his brief at Tote included leading the conversion of the company's fleet to LNG fuel, including fuel acquisition and supply chain activities. Mr. Keller, Peter oversaw the introduction of the first LNG-powered vessels in U.S. waters, the 2016-built Perla del Caribe and the 2015-built Isla Bella. Peter was previously executive vice president and COO of NYK Group Americas, before which he was a senior executive at Cast Group, having begun his career at container ship innovator Sealand with Malcolm McLaren. So Peter's an extremely experienced individual in the container shipping markets as well as in LNG fuel. Peter's always been a vocal proponent of safe ocean transport, having founded the Coalition for Responsible Transportation. He's also been a board member of the Pacific Maritime Association, the Pacific Maritime Shipping Association, and the U.S. Maritime Exchange, as well as serving for many years as chairman of the Ocean Carriers Equipment and Maintenance Association. So, Peter, we are honored to be able to say welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for that very complete introduction. I appreciate it. In a little more than 50 years in shipping, we do have an opportunity sometimes to do a number of varied and exciting things. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome. We're delighted to have you. And I must say, just before we came on air, Peter and I were just discussing our common experience in containerization and expansion of container ports on the U.S. East Coast back in the 2000s. But we should stick to LNG today. And Peter, with your personal experience of implementing LNG fueling in Tote Maritime ships, I wanted to focus a little bit on that. But first, I just wanted to get an overview from you with your CLNG hat on about global LNG bunkering developments, because we can see now that LNG is available in all six major bunkering countries. So South Korea, China, Singapore, the UAE, Netherlands, and USA. But how far along is LNG bunkering to meeting what I might call the martini principle, for those of us who are old enough to remember the advert for martini, which was anytime, any place, anywhere. So how far along that spectrum to the martini principle have we got now?
Well, we've seen a very tremendous growth just in the last 2 years, in all of the major bunkering hubs. And today, I think it's fair to say that you can bunker LNG at least by 2022 in virtually every major bunkering hub around the world. That has been very, very significant growth. We now see upwards of 50 LNG vessels or barges available in major bunkering hubs around the world, and there's a lot of discussion and a lot of ordering going on for additional vessels around the world. Are we going to be able to bunker LNG in every port and station? No. Are we going to be able to bunker LNG in all the major ports around the world? Yes. Not only can we bunker off of vessels and barges? We also have the capability of bunkering off of trucks, and as we proved at Tote some years ago, you can bunker 25 or 30 trail loads of LNG into a ship in a relatively small period of time, 5, 6, 7 hours, quite efficiently. And then we also now see the growth of what I would call gas stations. Titan, for example, is developing one in Europe to serve river barges and others. So we're going to see a continuing amount of growth in the bunker area, which obviously then supports the growth of new builds and new waters.
Yeah, and having had personal experience of bunkering LNG fueled vessels, what's the cost compared to traditional marine fuels, whether that's fuel oil or diesel?
Well, you know, the LNG as a cryogenic fuel requires a bit more handling in terms of the bunker capability. The bunkering is not yet mature, so the bunker vessels are not as busy as normal bunker operations would be. So there are some cost impediments there. But as we continue to see the growth of LNG ships and the bunkering continues to increase, that's going to change. The main difference really is the cryogenic nature of the fuel, which has to be dealt with and has to be dealt with safely, and obviously is, because we've been using LNG now as a maritime fuel for over 50 years without incident. And as we know, it is safe, and it's a very, very viable fuel, has been and will continue to be.
Yes, if there were to be a spill, which I think is as yet a theoretical incident, we've never seen an LNG spill, I suppose, it would simply evaporate and vent to air.
Well, we have seen spills, but in very, very minor ways. When you uncouple a hose, sometimes there may be a few pints or gallons of the liquid, and you're exactly right. It does evaporate. It cannot pollute the water, you just have to be careful with it, because if you spill it on the deck, it's so cold that it will, in fact, destroy the steel, which is why when we bunker typically over a water curtain, so that if there is even a spill of a pint or two, it immediately goes to the water and immediately evaporates. That's one of the beauties, really, of LNG in the maritime sector. With heavy fuels, obviously, if there is a spill, there is a major issue. With LNG, there is no issue because, as you point out, Mark, it evaporates and it goes into the air. That's not something we want to do, obviously, but at least we are not polluting the waters and creating other issues.
Yeah, and talking of cleanliness and lack of pollution, I remember reading an interview with you once in which you said if you go to the engine room on, I think it was the Ilabella you mentioned, but an LNG-powered ship, that you could go down there in your suit.
Absolutely. One of the things for those of us like yourself that have been in shipping for many years, we're used to going into the engine room, and when we go, we typically go in a boiler suit or we go and we always have gloves on, because it is dirty, because fossil fuels, the fuels we're used to, are dirty. We see it even in our cars. So when you go into an LNG boiler room, engine room, especially, let's say 3 or 4 years after the ship has been commissioned, as was the case a year or so ago when I went to visit the Islavea, it was quite amazing because it smells good. I mean, it still smells like an engine room, but it doesn't have that that fossil fuel kind of smell. It's clean. You can go down in your suit. You don't need to put gloves on. It's really quite interesting. And of course, one of the things that we don't talk about is that cleanliness and adds to the safety of the engine room. It also reduces costs, because you're not constantly cleaning up and doing these other things. And parts and things just seem to last longer.
Yeah, I think there's That's going to be a key issue for ship owners if they're thinking of either retrofitting or ordering new buildings with LNG fuel is the maintenance, isn't it? But I just wanted to think about that because, I mean, you were in charge of container ships running LNG, and that's probably where most of the action has been in shipping with the liner companies who have the biggest proportion of bunker demand of all the major shipping sectors. It's their biggest cost and what worries them the most. They've been switching over to LNG dual fuel ships. And there have been some orders now for LNG dual fuel bulk carriers and tankers. But overall, contracting volumes are at 40-year lows. They're at multi-decade lows because ship owners don't know what to build. And, you know, I know at CLNG you talk a lot about not waiting for the regulators to tell you what to do, that we've got to start now, and LNG gives us that opportunity. But what do you think it will take for tramp ship owners to order LNG dual fuel ships with confidence? And can one order them without time charter or contract cover?
First of all, when we look at what has to happen going forward, I think we need to understand that globally we still have air quality issues that need to be addressed, and of course, the IMO 2020. Sulfur requirements certainly moved us in that direction. But then we also have to be concerned about NOx and particulate matter, all of which are pretty well handled by LNG. Then we have the greenhouse gas, the carbon issues. And LNG right now will reduce that by about 20 to 21% from existing fuel sources. That's an important move forward. Does that get us to the IMO 2030 targets? No. But we can get there with LNG today, start to get that 20% reduction of greenhouse gases now, introduce bio-LNG or synthetic LNG products, which do not have a carbon molecule, which will then further reduce and meet the 2030 requirements. In terms of how ship owners look at that, we believe that it's very important to do something now. And we also know that as other alternative fuels may come forward in 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, the LNG infrastructure, the engines, can be made to burn some of these other fuels. So we basically future-proof our investment with the ability to do whatever may come along in another 10 or 20 years while getting all the benefits today. Now, in terms of the various markets, yes, 2020 has been a very difficult year for shipping. It's been a very difficult year for the world economy. As we see ship owners now starting to order ships again, we see more orders for LNG capable ships, the Hapag-Lloyd order, for example, of very large container ships, the CMA CGM move with more 14,000 type classes. But we also now see the PCTC market moving in very aggressively. NYK has made a number of announcements, and you can assume that others will follow. Sign has already come into the East Coast of the United States on behalf of Volkswagen with LNG ships, which one was recently bunkered in Jacksonville using Totes barge to clean Jacksonville. And that was a fairly large event given everything that's going on. So we are seeing other classes of vessels moving into LNG because the owners understand that if they are going to meet their environmental requirements going forward, they have to start now. We can't wait for 2025. We can't wait for 2030, because while we're waiting, we're just exacerbating the problem. We just make it worse. It's not getting better by itself. So we have to do something. And inaction, we don't see as a plan. As regards tramp, we have to remember these are dual fuel engines, so they will operate on diesel or other fuels if necessary. And as the LNG bunker market that we just discussed continues to grow, that will provide tramp operators with more comfort that they will be able to bunker even in smaller ports, or if they can't bunker with LNG because they're in some port that just does not have that capability, they can always use distillate for a while until they get to a port that does have LNG capabilities.
Mm-hmm. And those engines are designed to operate seamlessly between the two fuels.
Absolutely. When we were doing the exception testing on the engines, I actually went through the test cycle, and I was amazed that you just push a button on the console, and the engine goes from 100% diesel to what is really 1.5 or 2% diesel pilot fuel, and the rest LNG, and it did it, I want to say, in 2 or 3 minutes. And then as soon as we did that, we pushed the button again and it went back in the other direction. And the automation that MAN put into these engines and the monitoring capabilities and everything else is really pretty exciting, especially when you think that engine is 4 or 5 stories tall and you could sort of sit in the crankcase if you had a mind to.
So we've moved on from the days of ships' engines suffering thermal shock when they switched from fuel oil to diesel, and as they were entering the Californian ECA.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how the mechanization and the technology has advanced with marine engines, and that of course is one of the things that's helping with LNG, because it's the technology is reducing the slip in the 4-cylinder low pressure engines. That has changed dramatically over the last couple of years, and of course the high pressure systems have always been almost slip free. So we really see a lot of change going on as more and more engines are built. You have to remember when we were doing the tow ships, we had MAN's dual fuel engine number 1 and engine number 2. So we were basically the beta test site. And today, you know, they've built hundreds and hundreds more being built. And they're really developing that technology, not just MAN, but WinGD and Wärtsilä and all of the other large engine manufacturers are working very effectively on increasing the automation.
Yeah, tell us a bit about that, because you're one of the people in the world who has experience of fitting LNG engines into fuel oil ships, traditionally fuel oil powered ships. Can you tell us about the engineering and commercial challenges that you faced as a shipping company executive?
You know, when it came to LNG, the main challenges were not so much on the ship side, because of course the industry had been running LNG carriers on their own cargo for years. So while the dual fuel engine needed some development and some technology, it wasn't that unique. Developing and understanding how to use the fuel, how to take it from a cryogenic state back into a gaseous state, again, that had been done. So the biggest issues we had really were in supply chain and also in making sure that we had seamen and ship's engineers that were well trained in the use of cryogenics, and that was well handled by both the SIU and the AMO in the US, who really stepped up and did a lot of fine work and training, and still do today as the fleet continues to grow. But as regarded the logistics, you know, there was no LNG plant in Jacksonville. No one had ever designed a cryogenic barge, especially using the GTT membrane, which, so the LNG is stored in atmosphere. And when we elected to do the ships in Alaska, there was no LNG plant in Tacoma, Washington. Developing the logistics and the relationships was very important. And one of the things I always talk about when we talk about how we develop that it really is important who you pick as partners. Your partners are, those are the people that you have to rely on for the expertise, for the financing, for all of the hard work that goes into developing that system and that process. And when we went into the marketplace, we must have talked to 20 or 30 different people and eventually picked three or four or five core partners. And that was, those were the important decisions. Who do you deal with? Who do you partner with? And we were very fortunate in that we picked some very, very fine organizations. The group that founded Jax LNG, the Puget Sound Energy for the Tacoma plant, ACT, who developed our skid and a lot of our other technology work, and many others. Certainly GTT, developing the membrane, and Conrad that built the barge. It was important to have a nucleus of people like that that you were working with. And so when I'm asked, the answer is not what you yourself do. The answer is, who do you pick to work with, and who do you put that trust in?
Yeah. Well, I think that might be of some comfort to a number of our listeners, because that's how shipping traditionally works anyway. You pick your partners and you rely on people, and you sit, a ship is just one link in the value chain or in the supply chain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, whether it's your tug partner or whether you're, it's your engine maintenance partner or whatever, or your bunker partner, you've got to put that trust in people, and it really is a chain, and as with any other chain, it's only as strong as its weakest link. That's something that we say too often, but it is true, and picking partners is really the core of what one has to do whenever one goes into a new technology.
Yeah. I just want to move on a little bit there about, you mentioned earlier about the introduction of bio LNG and synthetic LNG, and both have strong claims to cut LNG's carbon footprint even further. Bio LNG sourced from a gas source from waste, from biological waste, and synthetic LNG, the catalyzing of captured carbon dioxide with hydrogen to create LNG molecule, natural gas molecules, which can then be liquefied and put into a marine fuels supply chain. They can really help to cut the CO2 output, the greenhouse gas emissions from an LNG engine on a, it won't be well to wake basis, but it'll be production to combustion basis. Is that how CLNG sees it?
Yes, because number one, bio LNG and synthetic LNG have exactly the same properties as LNG, and they liquefy exactly the same, burns exactly the same, just doesn't have the carbon molecule. So as we introduce more bio into the mix, we reduce the carbon footprint. We reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. Interestingly enough, when CMACGM first bunkered the Jacques Sade in Rotterdam a few weeks ago, they had 13% bio product in their mix. So with that, they're very, very close, if not meeting the IMO 2030 requirements for that ship. Very important. Also important to note that while we don't talk about it, what we do with garbage, what we do with landfill, what we do with waste, what we do with animal waste, what we do with vegetation waste, is really another major issue for our planet. And with the introduction of more bioproducts and a market for those bioproducts, we start to develop a much better, stronger market for our waste products. And I can tell you from experience and from things that I know and see and talk about every day these days, there are a lot of people now making very, very significant investments in biocapture. And we see companies like Gasum in Europe that are now starting to offer LNG with a mix of bio and carbon neutral products, so that ship owners can see a path to that 2030 and then that 2050 requirement. And that again is very, very important when we talk about LNG. We talk about doing something now. By doing something now, you set the stage for what happens next. And we know from a study that we had done by the University of Delft, which is a very well-known and well-respected organization, that there is going to be a significant growth in bioproducts, that growth will continue, and that bioproducts and then ultimately synthetic products will provide that pathway that we see to a zero carbon shipping environment. And we do that with existing technology. We do that with existing infrastructure. We're not going out and spending $1.5 trillion for a particular plant to develop ammonia or hydrogen. And we're doing it with a fuel that we know and understand and have worked with. And it has a strong energy content. We have to remember that many of the alternatives that people are talking about have about half the energy content of liquefied natural gas, of natural gas, which means that the ship has got to carry twice as much to make the same voyage. That's going to be an issue.
Yeah, sure. And especially when with LNG, you want to keep the bunker tanks as full as possible anyway, don't you? Because you don't want to have to cool down any residual LNG left in the tank.
You don't have to keep them full. You just always have to keep them cold. And that means you leave a little bit of what we call heel in the bottom of the tank. You never take the tank down completely. You always leave maybe 5 or 10% of the tank capacity, or you try to leave it in so that you don't have to cool the tanks again. Yeah.
Yeah, like I do with the family car, because Mrs. Williams doesn't always know how to put petrol in it. So
that's it. We all, most of us do not like to see that little red light go on.
No, not when you're halfway to the Childminders, no.
Well, especially when you're on Alligator Alley and it's 100 miles to the next gas station.
Quite, yeah. Yeah, you don't want to be running up those ladders. So, no. But you mentioned, you know, that with the addition of bio-LNG and synthetic LNG, both have got strong claims for this lower CO2 output, and that can give owners some comfort, I suppose, that they're not going to be buying or investing in a stranded asset, that actually LNG can take us to lower carbon LNG in the future, so we can continue to use the existing infrastructure, the existing ships. So, you know, if you order now, it's not going to be necessarily the case that the ship's going to be obsolete in a regulatory context by 2030.
Yeah, quite the contrary. The ship, with the introduction of bio and other products, the ship will, in fact, meet those 2030 requirements. And then you can see the pathway to meeting those 2050 products requirements that IMO and others are coming in. So it is future-proofed. And decisions that you make today are, in fact, sustainable for the life of the ship, 20, 30, 35 years. I'm going way out. So yeah, we certainly don't see that there's any issues with redundancy or with stranded assets. And as I say, quite the contrary. And we see the infrastructure building, and that infrastructure is going to be there for a long time, and it's going to be there to support that. And then that same infrastructure, as we've said a couple of times now, is the same infrastructure as you have with bio or ultimately synthetic products.
And then eventually, when the world can produce enough of green hydrogen, I understand that you can inject with modern LNG engines up to 20% hydrogen into the mix as well, so you can cut the carbon footprint even further.
We are told that is the case by the OEMs. Obviously, there's no ability to test that. And of course, we're a long way away from being able to provide those green products safely and reliably. And then, of course, there's also the issues of what it's going to take from a technology point of view, and what it's going to take from an infrastructure development point of view, and then who's going to fund all that. Because at the end of the day, you know, a lot of these ideas are great, and some of them may in fact turn out to be commercially viable. But it's going to take a lot of money to get there. And we really don't know what the outcome is going to be. While with LNG and then bioproducts, we know the outcome. And we've known the outcome for 40 or 50 years because we've been using it. And it's safe, it's reliable, and we've got it in large quantities.
Yeah, it's the only fossil fuel that's likely to have growth, significant growth in production compared to today's levels over the next couple of decades, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Peter, I know we're running out of time and we have to let you go to move on to your next appointment, but thank you so much for taking the time out to join us today on the Ship.Energy podcast. Really appreciate that. Thank you.
Mark, thank you very much. I enjoyed spending some time with you and look forward to doing it again.
Thanks so much. And thank you to all our listeners, and bye for now. We'll see you soon.